Hello, and welcome to our program, the National Geographic Society, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Jim Cruz, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the National Geographic magazine and website here on Owl Radio. We start our December program with a letter from the editor. The special issue for this year was Pictures of the Year. The editor, Nathan Lump, writes, "Years ago, when I was starting to explore the world in earnest, making my first trips to Africa, Asia, Arctic, I made the decision not to take a lot of, or in some cases, any, photographs. At the time, I believed that looking at the world through a lens hindered my ability to see what was really in front of me. I thought that trying to capture good pictures took me out of the moment and made me conscious of constructing an image rather than absorbing what I was experiencing. I've since changed my mind about that. Today I have and take plenty of photos, not just on my travels, but in the everyday. When I notice an interesting mushroom while walking the dog, or watch the cloud formations before a storm, or admire an artful display of flowers at my local coffee shop. I still think the act of photography can be distracting, certainly in a time when we all have powerful cameras in our pockets and one of the planet's biggest platforms for engaging with others is fueled by a steady flow of images. But I also understand now that taking pictures can be a way to stop and linger, to consciously capture a moment in time and make better sense of the world around us. That's one important outcome of the program that our phenomenal photographers do for National Geographic. And that's why I'm so pleased that we have dedicated this month's magazine to immersing you in that work. Of course, these professionals have a much different relationship with photography than I do. Their work is creatively, intellectually, logistically challenging in ways that most of us hobbyist photographers can hardly imagine. For them, it's an art and a science that they've perfected, a way to stop us in our tracks and make us pay attention to a story that needs to be told. At their best, photographers reveal what isn't readily seen. For this special issue, our talented team has curated a collection of the best images from National Geographic photographers who were in the field over the past year. Some take you back to stories that you've already appeared in our pages. If you missed any of those, head over to nationalgeographic.com. And some are related to stories we'll be publishing in the months to come. What they all have in common is the power to let you see something and understand something in an entirely new way. And taken together, they are a portrait of our world and the wonder of it all in 2022. In addition to showing you this stunning array of photos, we're letting you hear directly from a handful of our photographers who share stories that take you deeper into some of their most interesting projects. You'll learn the extreme lengths to which our contributors have gone to capture some of these shorts and get a closer look at the gear that makes it all possible. And because photography is at the heart of what we do every day on Instagram, where more than 230 million people like and comment on the images we post, we pulled in a selection of the photos our followers have loved over the past year. If you're not already part of our community, do check us out at Nat Geo for a daily dose of inspiration. We begin with a picture. Kennedy Space Center, Florida. Lunar Dream. With its Artemis 1 mission, NASA is kicking off an ambitious plan to return humans to the moon. When the rocket launches, the uncrewed trip's commander will be the Munichen Campos, named after a NASA engineer who helped save the lives of the Apollo 13 crew. During a trip around the moon, slated to last more than a month, Campos is sitting in for crew in the Orion capsule. Sensors in Campos's headrest and behind its seat track vibration and acceleration, expected to reach 4 times that of Earth's gravity. Campos wears radiation sensors and a survival suit that future missions' flesh and blood passengers will use during launch, reentry, and other critical moments. NASA hopes a crew of 4 will make the next trek aboard Orion as early as May 2024 as part of Artemis II. Photograph by Dan Winters. Where in the world? On assignment, National Geographic photographers crisscrossed the globe this past year to capture glimpses of our shared human journey and the incredible planet we call home. 132 photographers were sent out. They visited 60 countries. 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Heat recorded by Matthew Pally as he followed Sufi pilgrims in Pakistan's Sindh and Balochistan provinces. Minus 49 degrees. Cold measured by Pat Kane in Canada's Northwest Territories while covering indigenous trappers. Corning, New York. Ceramics that bend the mind. It's tempting to think of ceramics as strong yet brittle, like a coffee cup shattered on a kitchen floor. But to scientists at glass and ceramics manufacturer Corning, they're flexible and durable. The ribbon ceramics they've devised can be spooled into strips thinner than a sheet of paper. The loops of heat-tolerant alumina, which is seen here, in about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 loops and then a single streck one. The ceramic is in white, and the technicians are holding blue gloves. The loops of heat-tolerant alumina could make automotive sensors and other devices used in harsh environments quicker and cheaper to produce. They could also enable new kinds of batteries. The photographer captured the innovation as part of a 10-year project focused on the influence of U.S.-based manufacturers. Photograph by Christopher Payne. Line Islands, Kiribati, Resilience in the Deep. Photograph by Enrique Sala. On the bottom of the picture is coral that's a brownish color. Throughout the whole picture, fish that are yellow on top and pink on the bottom. And through the midst of it glides a gray shark. Around Vostok and other southern line islands in the remote central Pacific, abundant small reef fish support a thriving population of top predators. Here a gray reef shark swims over Montipora corals in a sea of fusilier damselfish and Bartlett's antheus. Enrique Sala, a National Geographic explorer in residence, visited the area in 2009 for his Pristine Seas project, which conducted the first scientific surveys of marine life around the islands and recommended protection. Now the sea around the islands is a reserve, which may have helped it recover from a dramatic coral die-off in the wake of the 2015-2016 El Nino warming event. On this more recent trip, Sala captured the reefs and restored to their former glory. By the numbers! In intense trip preparation, the physical demands of field work, the real-time education in every assignment, and the feeling of genuinely connecting with a subject. When photographers are in the field for National Geographic, many aspects of the job are hard to quantify. With our photographer's help, we collected the statistics above. They show how efforts amounted to the images we published during the year in print, online, and across our social accounts. 29,032. Elevation and feet obtained by Evan Green as part of the first all-black team to summit Everest. 9. Remote cameras Dan Winters had pointed at Artemis 1 on September 27th until its launch was halted as Hurricane Ian formed. 2,238,899. images filed by all photographers. 9,869. Depth and feet of the Endurance shipwreck, whose discovery was documented by Esther Horvath. 4,000. 4,000 pounds of gear staff photo engineer Tom O'Brien shipped into the field. 44. Photographers who completed their first National Geographic assignment. 4. Types of transport, including a powered paraglider, Ben Depp used to document Louisiana's coast. And 1. Tripod taken by a hyena when Jim Guyton was photographing the animals in Kenya. Through the lens. Kali'i Yuyan. Survival skills and empathy help this photographer thrive in extreme environments and diverse cultures. I'm gliding on ice, inhaling the crisp April air of Greenland's high Arctic, accompanied by the rhythmic whooshing of sled dogs. I kneel on the back of a sled, making photographs of Inuit hunter Quiggapik Guama Gvist and his dog team. That's me holding the camera above. I'm on the quintessential National Geographic assignment, dog sledding across roughly 30 miles of sea ice in search of the unicorn of the sea, the narwhal. Week after week, we've been coming out to the sea ice of Englefield Fjord, seeking a path to where ice meets water. After 5 weeks, when we finally come up on a small area of open water, Kuma tests the ice with a heavy pole. It's mushy, but underneath the softness lies dependable ice. Our lives depend on that ice holding together. I decide I'll go first into the frigid water with one of the kayaks we've lashed to the sleds. Kuma and another hunter, Kriong Kurakik, give each other an uneasy glance. But they launch me anyway and watch nervously as I fumble around with my camera for a few minutes. Then my kayak takes off like a shot. It rockets over the glassy water, coming to a stop only after I execute an expert turn with my paddle. Across the water, I can see the hunter's mouths turn upward. For years prior to becoming a photographer, I built and paddled traditional kayaks. They knew that, but now they were seeing proof. The Inuit launch their own kayaks. We start searching for narwhals, spending this afternoon looking for signs of them around the water's edge. Lost cause. The thin, rotting ice still extends way out of the fjord into the sea, preventing the narwhals from surfacing for a breath. They can't get into this area to fish for halibut or to give birth. By mid-June, I can't stay any longer. The thin ice remains in place, and the narwhals stay locked out of their calving grounds. 2 months later than usual, as my plane gains altitude over the sea ice for the long return south, I look down and see dog teams mushing around the village, a seemingly timeless sight in this climate of unyielding change. North Greenland, home to the indigenous Inuit, is one of the few places on Earth where the most reliable form of transportation during much of the year is a dog sled. Now, it might seem odd to most people. After all, dog sledding takes time, which means long exposure to bitter cold. Dogs need to be fed, cared for. Mushers also need to be trained and in good fitness. Nevertheless, the community of Quakok has remained quite deliberately a place where dog sledding is a common way to get around. Sleds are slow, quiet, and demand constant observation of the sea ice and its wildlife. Unlike snowmobiles, they don't break down. And when you get into an emergency survival situation, commonplace, it's good to remember, you can't eat a snowmobile. As a photographer of Nanol, that's East Asian indigenous, and Chinese descent, raised by my immigrant parents in the United States, I know how difficult it is to understand the perspectives of different cultures. I believe it's essential. My mission is to try to understand how the thousands of wildly varied native cultures around the world managed to be so good at land stewardship, while this modern globalized culture has basically dropped the ball. The stakes for the environment we live in are high, and we all know it. The issues from climate change to habitat destruction seem dire. But my friends know me as an optimist. That's because I see the solutions are already out there, and in practice at this very moment. 80% of the world's existing land biodiversity is on territories managed by indigenous peoples who make up just 5% of the global population. Nearly all of that territory encompasses people making a living with wildlife. This is where my hope lives. Native communities are incredibly good at stewarding their lands, and it's not because they are any more enlightened than anyone else. Indigenous peoples recognize human tendencies towards selfishness and greed. They have evolved all kinds of social structures, which one might even call technologies, to combat our destructive impulses. Indigenous peoples are not somehow magical, but they are exceptionally diverse. All those thousands of cultures represent individual experiments in how humans manage themselves and their surroundings. And when trying to solve thorny problems, possibilities are needed. Indigenous cultures also have had millennia to refine their solutions to problems, providing not only a variety of models, but mostly good models. It's hard to survive if you degrade the land that gives you life. In past centuries, indigenous peoples have stewarded their lands independently. Today, the threats their territories face are orders of magnitude greater. Mining, oil extraction, development are rapidly eating away pristine homelands from the Amazon to the Arctic. It's my hope that powerful stories can help the industrialized world learn from indigenous models, as well as support native communities working towards solutions. Though I'm often engaged with heady thoughts like these, I remember that spring afternoon as we mushed across the ice and my mind was at peace. Our Greenlandic team paused to hunt a seal, feed the dogs with the blubber, and stew the ribs for dinner. Well, that day we covered 30 miles on seal fuel. That, my friends, is a recipe for not only a great assignment, but also for good living. Outstanding Storytelling Award winner. The prestigious annual Eliza Skidmore Award is presented by the National Geographic Society. The award is named for the writer and photographer who, in 1892, became the first woman elected to the Society's board. This year's award recognizes Khalil Uyan for his photographic storytelling that illuminates communities connected to the land. Working remotely, our editors quiz photographers about their experiences in the field, and here's some of their answers. What's the one item you always take on or bring back from an assignment? Saul Martinez, my son Oliver was born in May of 2021. Since then, I've kept one of the socks he wore as a newborn. I've taken it everywhere with me. Pat Kane, I always bring tobacco to offer the land as a spiritual gesture of respect for nature and to ask for safety when traveling. Katerine Einner, there is a bobcat fetish that lives in my camera bag. It comes all over the world with me. Billy Uyan, an FDA-approved device for motion sickness that looks like a watch but shocks like an electric eel, which is very handy when flying in bush planes or rocking around ocean swells on a boat. David Monteleon, I like to get a shave from a local barber wherever I go. Sarah Hilton, my father's college ring. Anoush Babayana, a small paper heart, which a little girl gave me while I was on assignment in Magnolia. Ruben Salgado Escudero, travel yoga mat. Best way to start or finish a day in the field is with some meditation and stretching. Keith Ladzinski, I always try to find a stray feather and bring it home for my son. It's a fun way to share my experience and show him a little piece of the world. Max Stone, I always bring hot sauce. That makes every camping meal go from 2 stars to 4 stars anytime. Describe a memorable first while on assignment. Yun Michael Pak. It was my first chance to see moon bears in their natural habitat with Korea National Park rangers. I spotted lumps of black moving in the bushes about 650 feet away. I lifted my camera when a ranger grabbed me and says, we gotta go. I later learned that the mother bear had sensed us, instructed the cubs to move, and could have attacked us. Robbie Schoen, Naked Caving. Inside Popiegud, one of Earth's largest crystal caves in Spain, it was extremely hot, so we had very little time allowed for making photographs. To maximize the time, I stripped 100% and only wore the white paper suit. It worked. I bought myself 10 extra minutes. Kendrick Brinson, a 600-pound pig on a farm in Virginia. She looked at me, crawled out of her mud pit, and jogged over to rub her muddy nose on my lens. Victor Amoriyama, seeing a completely dead mangrove forest from climate change effects was one of the most remarkable experiences. The dry trees are reminiscent of horror movie scenes. Paolo Verzon, shooting inside the tomb of Tutankhamun was a mysterious and magical experience. Marcel Ethereal Garcia, halfway through an assignment in the Sierra Sur of Oaxaca, I decided to include my feet in the sensory journey and walk around barefoot. Babak Tafrishi, I was documenting the nighttime landscape of New Hampshire's White Mountains when high-energy particles from a solar eruption arrived in the Earth's magnetic field, and bright vertical rays of the northern lights appeared. Tell us about a memorable save in the field. Jasper Dost, rushing out to a human-wildlife contact site in Gabon. I forgot to bring water. After 10 hours in the blazing sun, I was getting seriously dehydrated. When a train approached, a man hanging out the window dropped a water bottle while shouting, "Water for the National Geographic photographer," as the train continued. Joel Sartori, out by myself in Alaska. I stepped to a cliff edge to get a photo, and the spot I was standing on evaporated. I managed to grab a clump of grass with one hand, which kept me falling 200 feet. I shot a couple of quick frames with the other hand. I figured, what the heck? Then pulled on the grass to crawl slowly back up. Max Stone. I was photographing the oldest cypress tree in the world when all of a sudden a comet-like light streaked across the only open part of the sky in my frame. It was completely unexpected, and I had only one shot to make it. Turned out to be the SpaceX rocket. Irene Yee, photographing a rock climb 60 feet off the ground in Liming, China. I held my camera by my fingertips, ready to drop it to my side, as it's always tethered to my body harness. Then I saw its tether dangling unattached. Thankfully, in my panic, I gripped harder instead of dropping it. Keith Lanzinski. I was diving with a leopard seal in Antarctica when a current beached us both on a piece of sea ice. For about 30 seconds, my camera housing was the only thing between us, and the attacking seal bit it repeatedly. Once the seal wriggled back into the water, my Zodiac driver swooped in and pulled me off the ice into the boat. Lynn Johnson. Well, I was almost run over, say killed, by a zebra while I own a store in Zambia, so I have taken the zebra as my talisman animal. After all, I was photographing that project in black and white. So many stories, I can't decide. Okay, King Tut's Eternal Mystique, a photograph by Paolo Verzoni. It's a photograph of a Egyptian figure standing in front of some gray stone with winged arms and a protective spread. This relief of the Egyptian goddess Isis has stood guard for millennia on the stone sarcophagus of the pharaoh Tutankhamun. Isis has witnessed a great deal. Soon after Tut's burial in Egypt's Valley of the Kings in the 14th century BC, grave robbers ransacked parts of the tomb. Then in 1922, a team led by British archaeologist Howard Carter rediscovered the burial site and fully excavated it. Nearly all of Tutankhamun's belongings now reside in the lavish Grand Egyptian Museum, which opens soon outside Cairo. The sarcophagus, though, remains within the necropolis, along with the boy king's mummy. Enduring mystery solved. Explorer Ernst Henry Shackleton and his crew in 1915 all survived when ice crushed their ship Endurance off the coast of Antarctica. The three-masted oak-hulled barkentine, long lost in the depths of the Weddell Sea, was discovered in astonishingly good condition nearly 10,000 feet down in March 2022. The Endurance 22 expedition, using autonomous underwater vehicles, located the ship and spotted the brass lettering on its stern, well preserved by cold temperatures, lack of light, and low oxygen. The picture from the Weddell Sea shows the steering column as well as the bow of the ship. Esther Horvat photographed August II plowing through thick Antarctic ice floes. The treacherous weather made securing camera equipment on board a challenge. She says, "It was so windy out there, I had to use my entire body weight to hold down my tripod. Searching and moving in the polar darkness has a certain mystery I'm drawn to. It's an echo of the underwater world." Kennedy Space Center, Florida, "The Next Ride to the Moon" by Dan Winters. Shrouded in morning mist, NASA's Space Launch System looms over Kennedy Space Center's Launch Complex 39B in March as the rocket awaits testing. The 322-foot-tall vehicle is the linchpin of NASA's Artemis program, which aims to land the first woman and first person of color on the moon and use it as a stepping stone to Mars. With two boosters and four main engines, SLS can fling a crew capsule moonward with 8.8 million pounds of thrust, 15% more oomph than the Apollo program's Saturn V rockets. Each SLS will be used only once. After this rocket's launch, during an uncrewed test flight planned for this year, its pieces are expected to fall either into the ocean or enter orbit around the sun. Well, you've been listening to the National Geographic Society here on Owl Radio. Now, you can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio, or you can listen by streaming on your computer or smartphone. Listen at your convenience on our podcast at www.owlradio.org. Well, thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. Until next time, this is Jim Cruz saying goodbye from Owl Radio.